how the King James Bible was translated and everything leading up to that, and kind of going through some of the analogies of you know, the comparisons that are made to modern versions and also other things. So anyway, so we're going to start out with the critics of the Authorized Version. So you have those that, there's kind of two groups of people that are critics of the AV 1611, those who know the truth and those who are misguided by teachers. So the first group, those that are know the truth, this is typically your college professor or something of that nature. And the reason people respect them is, you know, they've attained to that position. So they kind of build a pride over time, and that pride puts them on an equal level with the Bible, or at least they think so in their mind. And otherwise, the other option is they just could be agents of the Roman Catholic Church like the Jesuits. And then you have those that are taught by these teachers or misguided by them. So you have the young college student, the young man that goes away to college, or young lady, and they're taught by it, and, you know, they're just lay folks in the church, and their pride can also draw them into that criticism. But it's that second group that you probably have a chance of helping, probably that first group, not likely. And so the approach that they've taken to replace the King James 11 is many rather than one. So Rome figured out pretty quickly with the Latin Vulgate, Jerome's Latin Vulgate in particular, that, you know, just not one translation was going to be able to replace the 1611. So they kind of needed to have a repeat fire campaign and just kind of keep bringing new translations out, just like you'd sell a new model of a car or whatever. And that's, they basically needed a modern day sales pitch to be able to keep up the pressure, because you're just not going to replace it. So like I said, they kind of use that salesman pitch approach, and, you know, people basically needed to be convinced that their Bible was old and archaic and needed replaced, just like any, you know, car or house or appliance or whatever. You just, you know, it's a advertising gimmick. And so the analogy that's kind of a little bit different than, you know, modern day advertising is they always compare back to the 1611. And, you know, that isn't the way things are done with advertising, but, you know, one way you can tell a false prophet or a false Bible is it always attacks either the true prophet or the true Bible. And, you know, the analogy I'm going to use here is the Model T. So, you know, sort of the way they look at it is it'd be like comparing a 1922 Model T to a 2022 Chevrolet Corvette. So the advertising would say the Corvette's 495 horsepower mid-level engine with an 8-speed dual-clutch transmission is better than a Model T with a 2-speed planetary gear clutch, you know. So that's not a very good analogy, you know, and not even in the same ballpark. But that's what, in reality, they're doing every time they try to bring out a new Bible. They don't ever compare back, you know, like the, you know, the revised NIV or NIRV or whatever doesn't compare back to the NIV. It always compares back to the 1611. And so it's, you know, it makes absolutely no sense, but, you know, when you got a false premise, that's what you got to do. And so they need to improve, and in reality, they're not really improving on one another. They're always just trying to replace the King James. And so there's false prophets, false Bibles, and AB 1611, if it was truly irrelevant, as they say, they wouldn't keep going back and comparing to it. And so the reality is the AV 1611 is a true gold standard and always will be the gold standard that they compare back to. So like I said, Bible advertising, it's a sales pitch. And so basically every time a new version comes out, it claims to correct the mistakes in the AV 1611. And that's what the revised versions, the premise of the revised version was from the beginning. And so we're made to feel insecure about our King James Bible. It's no longer relevant in society, is what they say. And then the new version's unveiled and claims to be thoroughly reliable, true to the original Greek, and starting a new tradition. And then they make the claim the KJV is old and archaic. And so they claim this new translation more accurate, more reliable, easier to read, and it contains all the major doctrines. And so the person's then talked into this new Bible out of their KJV, and they have a new translation. Then comes the letdown. So once they get home, let's say they're confronted by false doctrine, you know, either by a Jehovah's Witness or something like that. And then they find out many of the verses they've grown to depend on in their Bible are either not there or they're watered down. For example, 1 John 5:7, the Trinity. You know, this is a very critical verse when it comes to verses that the, you know, these new Bibles attack. And so it says in 1 John 5:7, "For there are three that bear record in heaven, the Father, Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one." And for example, the NIV says, "For there are three that testify." And so you got a very clear teaching of the Trinity in that verse. And, you know, it's almost, well, not almost, it is completely gone in 1 John 5:7. And then you have the divinity of Christ, or that Christ is God. It's clearly taught in John 1:18, "No man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him." And then you got a couple of verses from the NIV, and they kind of water down that divinity of Christ. And so those type of things happen all throughout these new translations. I mean, these are just a couple examples, but there's literally hundreds of them where they water down the Word of God and things go away. So the common defense that a lot of these new versions use is that they say you can, quote unquote, find the fundamentals in them. Well, I mean, you can find a tic-tac on the floor, but it's been sitting there for 3 years or something. You know, that doesn't mean that, you know, that's a tic-tac factory. You know, it's kind of a dumb analogy, but you get what I'm saying. So the problem is that the authorized version, maybe, for example, on a given doctrine, might have 30 verses that teach on that doctrine, whereas this new translation has cut it down to 15 or 20, you know, and it's those 10 to 15 verses that it takes and it waters it down. What's it doing? It's slowly watering it down. Well, that's probably fine if you got a ton of verses that teach, you know, something like salvation or something like that. Yeah, you can find salvation probably in a modern version at some level, but it's watered down. So the problem comes when you only have a handful of verses. For example, the bodily resurrection of Christ is only taught in three verses in the Bible, in Acts 1:9, Luke 24:51, and Mark 16:19. Well, in the NASV, that doctrine is only clearly taught in Acts 1:9, and it basically, you know, does not make it clear that Christ bodily arose from the earth in those other two verses. And so you see what, you know, and kind of as a general rule of thumb, you don't ever want to build a doctrine on a single verse. So now you got a Bible that is teaching a critical doctrine about Jesus Christ raising from the dead on one verse. And so that's when you really get into big issues. And so we have the scholarship comparison. So we're going to compare sort of how modern scholarship translated the Bible versus the author, what they did with the authorized version. So modern scholarship, you know, claims they have authority to change the AV 1611 because, quote unquote, scholarship is so much better nowadays than it was in 1604 when they started the translation. So in reality, you know, and we know this as Christians and just living in the world, that the world is going downhill. It's not going uphill, and especially education. I mean, you know, yes, technologically maybe we're better, but I would argue education-wise we're getting worse and worse. And, I've seen that even in the college system since I was taught in the 90s. I mean, I don't think engineers are getting taught better than they were back then. And it's that way across the board. I mean, you know, I mean, it's so bad in colleges nowadays, they basically got to reteach them high school. You know, it's ridiculous. I had a boss that taught in a community college, and it's kind of a joke almost, you know. So you would think with all this advancement in education that we would be better along, but we're actually falling behind the rest of the world in the U.S. here. And that's true about any kind of scholarship. You know, you got more distractions in this world than we did 400 years ago. So, unfortunately, people are getting dumber and dumber. So reality is they need to basically, instead of the scholarship really being better, they need like an advertising campaign to pump all this up. And, you know, for example, the Lachman Foundation, when they translated the NASV, believed they did a great service by trying to pump energy into this new translation because interest in the ESV was waning. So, you know, interest in the King James Bible has not waned in 400 years, you know. And so, you know, if you got to pump it up, it's not the real thing. It's just an advertising campaign. And so, in contrast, the Authorized Version scholarship was much different. So these were far greater men of God than Westcott and Hort or any other modern translator. In the dedicatory to the King James Bible, it stated, "So that if, on one side, we be transduced by popish persons at home or abroad, who therefore will malign us, because we are poor in instruments to make God's holy truth to be yet more and more known unto the people whom they desire still to keep in ignorance and darkness, or if on the other side we should be maligned by self-conceited brethren who run their own ways and giving like unto nothing, but what is framed by themselves and hammered on their anvil." And so, you know, you see very high-end scholarship here, but, you know, basically, when they translated this Bible, they realized they were going to get attacked either immediately or down the road. And there were two groups of people that they were trying, you know, that they almost prophetically told of that were going to attack the Bible. So popish persons. So you have the Roman Catholic Church has long hated the King James Bible, and they still do. And their supreme goal has always been to eliminate it, and that's what all of these modern translations. And then you have self-conceited brethren. These are scholars like Westcott and Hort believe their opinion is more important than the Word of God, and they're never going to submit to a book. So in reality, this period of time between 1604 and 1611 was kind of at the height of the English Empire. This was almost, I would call it a parenthesis in purity. And, you know, it was between, you know, they'd overthrown Roman authority in England, and it was before the Church of England basically went into apostasy. So this was, you know, the height of the Puritans, height of everything going on in England. And, you know, and it was not too long after this, you know, probably within 100 years that England started going downhill, unfortunately. But this was the height of purity of England. So there was no way all these great colleges, denominations, churches of Great Britain and America could possibly bring together that same number and quality of people with equal qualifications and purity to what was assembled there in 1604. And so they established this translation committee, and it was done at the direction of King James, obviously. And so these men were chosen, at least the primary ones, directly by King James himself. And they were chosen to translate this Bible, and they were organized into three companies, and we'll kind of get through it. And there were two divisions to each of these companies. There's six total companies. And roughly a total of 50 men were split up between these companies, and each of them was in charge of translating a certain portion of the Bible. And, you know, these were older men. Obviously, seven of them died before the translation was completed, and some of them were replaced along the way. But, you know, these divines were selected for companies at this conference by the Hampton Court by King James. So, you know, basically King James had a court, Hampton Court, you know, that's basically how they organized meetings of kings. And he selected these men to oversee this translation of the Bible. And so they basically set up a committee rules at that time in that court and basically set up the guidelines. So it had to start from the bishop's Bible and alter as little as possible. Names of prophets were to be retained as they were commonly used. Old ecclesiastical words to be kept, like church rather than congregation. Words needed to line up with church fathers' teachings. Don't change the divisions or the chapters if all possible. No marginal notes. You know, marginal notes for cross-reference were okay, but not like correction of the text. Chapters that are translated individually need to come before the committees and discussed and conferenced upon. They need to send the translation from one company to another to have the work cross-checked. And this was required of King James in particular. you know, they basically, you know, each of these individual companies, I'll get into it, translated a certain number of books of the Bible. And as, you know, they cross-checked it within the company, and then they cross-checked these translations company to company. And, you know, it was a very sophisticated system of checks and checks and rechecks. And then they needed to work out any differences among these committees or companies and fix the problems. If there were things that were too difficult for the committee to come to the conclusion, they were to send letters to those throughout the land. So they had authority to basically make this a nationwide project. That's really what it was. It was a multi-university, full nation project. And the letters were sent to every bishop in England and the rest of their clergy so they could enlist anyone who was skillful in translation of the work. So just because you were on the committee, you had authority to also basically enlist subjugates or people under you that you knew. Like if you knew a guy was very good at a certain thing, you could reach out to them and had authority from the king to do that. The directors that were selected for each of the three companies were to be deans of Westminster and Chester for Westminster. And so Westminster was a college and Chester was another college. And these were the king's professors in Hebrew and Greek in the two universities. So these were like unique high-level positions at these universities. And they were basically the top-tier people in England relative to Hebrew and Greek. And those were the ones that oversaw it. And so they had very distinct review rules. And so once each company finished its work or each of these six companies finished their portion of the Bible, the work was reviewed within that company and then sent, like I said, to the other five. After that work was reviewed by those outside the original six companies, it also was examined by men across the empire. And then after this review, it was reviewed by a final board of six men of the original translators and sent to the printers at Oxford. And so the materials they had access to. They had a wealth of materials that were gathered from all over England for the translation. They had both Hebrew and Greek witnesses, everything that was available. They had Erasmus, Beza, and Stephanus' Greek manuscripts. They had Latin, the Syrian, the Chaldean, the Spanish, French, Dutch, and Italian manuscripts. And they even used the Douay Rheims English for sake of comparison. The physical layout, they included the Apocrypha in the original King James Bible. It was to be included between the Testaments rather than scattered throughout as the Catholic translations do. And it was basically meant to be there for historical reference. Words were added by the any words that were added by the translator were placed in italics. The chapter and verse divisions were to follow the system of the Geneva Bible. And Gothic type was used to its detriment. So that, you know, that's kind of why people refer to the King James Bible as archaic, because it used Gothic type, and we kind of covered that before. But in reality, they did away with the Gothic type pretty quickly after 1611. And so when it was completed, copies were sent to the royal presses at Oxford and Cambridge in 1611, and you can still buy Bibles off those same presses 410 years later. And so the men of the committee, so we're going to go through the six companies. The first company was the first Westminster Company. I believe there was 10 men total that were in this company, and they were responsible for translating Genesis, the Second Kings. The head of that committee was Dr. Lancelot Andrews, lived from 1555 to 1626. He was and I'm not going to go through every one of these qualifications of these guys, but you get the idea that these guys were not just in the university. They were at the tops of the, you know, departments that they were in. And England had a very sophisticated university system in 1600. I mean, we don't think about things like that, but it's on par, you know, and this is kind of where all the modern universities in the United States came from, was based on this principle that was established in England, and they modeled themselves after this. So, you know, this type of system even goes into existence today. And so these were the top men. And a lot of these men were not just in universities. They were also in the hierarchy of the Church of England at the time. They were the bishops or the highest levels in the church. So they were very well respected. Dr. Lancelot was a master at Pembroke. He was a dean at Westminster University. He was also a bishop at Chichester, bishop at Ely, bishop at Winchester. And he was the first person named in order agreed upon the translation. So this was, he was the top guy, basically, if you want to think of it that way. This was the first guy King James wanted. And he was so well taught that he would learn a language once a year during a month-long vacation at his parents' house in the spring. So how many people go on vacation and learn a whole new language? And to the point that at his time of death, he knew 15 different languages very explicitly. And not only was he very well learned, but he was had great practical preaching ability and a hatred of Rome. He was referred to as the star of preachers in his time. He was a great man of prayer. And he was given to hospitality, showing that he was a humble man and still loved the brethren. And, you know, in reality, this was a godly man that probably did not have a match in modern times. You have Dr. Oliver John Overall, lived from 1558 to 1619. You see, a lot of these guys did not live too long after the translation, so they were either old or whatever. He was a Regius Professor at Divinity at St. Paul. Lived in 1601. He was a bishop of several places. Member of the court of the High Commission. He opposed scriptural perversions of Rome. And you see that these men had a hatred of Rome, as they should at the time. Had a vast knowledge of the early church fathers and their quotations. And he would have been one that they relied on to deal with things like the Johannine comma in 1 John 5:7. As I said, that's a very controversial verse. And none of the modern translators have so exhaustively invested in the evidence of church fathers like Dr. Overall would have. And so you see that these men had a lot of capability beyond just translating either Hebrew or Greek. You had Dr. Hadrian Savannah, professor of divinity at Leyden, a prebendary of Gloucester, a prebendary of Westminster, that was just a position in the church. He was just as evangelistic as he was scholarly, and he was sent by Queen Elizabeth as a sort of a missionary to the islands of Guernsey and Jersey at one time as one of the first Protestant ministers, and he established Elizabeth College, which is still there today. Dr. Richard Clark, he was a fellow of Christ College at Cambridge, vicar of minister in Moncton and Isle of Thanet, and he had a volume of sermons which he was published after his death. Dr. John Layfield was a fellow of Trinity, chaplain to Earl of Cumberland. He was also a skilled architect. This helped with translations relative to things in the tabernacle and the temple. So these men had skills well beyond just being able to translate, and there was a lot of depth in this translation committee. Dr. Robert Tingey said of him in McClure's book, an excellent textuary and profound linguist, and they're employed in the translation of the Bible. You had Francis Burley, a vicar of Bishops Stortford, Dr. Jeffrey King, a fellow at King's College in Cambridge, Regius Professor of Hebrew at Cambridge, Richard Thompson at Clare Hall, Cambridge, and then Dr. William Bedwell, rector of St. Hildebrand's Bishopgate and vicar of Tottenham. He was an eminent Oriental scholar. He was considered the principal Arabic scholar of the time that he lived. He understood Arabic and Oriental language and is critical to the translation of the Old Testament. He was likely well beyond any modern day scholars in this area as well. So these 10 men translated, like I said, up to 2 Kings. Now you have the First Cambridge Company that translated from 1 Chronicles through Ecclesiastes. That committee was headed up by Dr. Edward Levy. He was a Regius Professor of Hebrew at Cambridge, prebendary at Petersburg, and it is said that no man living exceeded him in knowledge of the Oriental languages. He did in 1605... He died in 1605, and it said the great effort he was putting into the translation of the Bible hastened his death, likely. So these men gave their lives to this translation. It was something they were probably waiting for and were very glad to participate. You have Dr. Lawrence Chatterton. He was a fellow of Christ College, Master Emmanuel College, raised Roman Catholic, but was converted to Christ. And he joined the Puritan congregation in London. He learned Latin, Greek, and Hebrew and was thoroughly skilled in them. At the same time, he was a powerful preacher who lived to 103, where congregations never tired of his preaching. And he was able to maintain an intense scholarship without letting it deaden or dry his preaching. So you see that these men were not just dead scholars like Westcott and Hort. They were great preachers. They were great men of God. Dr. Francis Dillingham was a fellow at Christ College. He authored several theological treatises, and he was so studied in the original language that he was able to participate in public debate on Greek. And if you're going to participate in public debate on something, you got to be very skilled because you got to be on your toes, and you know, you never know who somebody's going to throw at you. He was an ardent opponent at Rome because he was raised Roman Catholic and converted, and would write treatises against Rome's doctrine in favor of Protestantism. So you can see these men were staunch anti-Catholic. You had Dr. Thomas Harrison, Vice Master of Trinity College. He was another fervent Puritan. Chose to assist with the translation because of his knowledge of Greek and Hebrew. And he was a chief examiner for Greek and Hebrew professors at Trinity. So that meant that basically he oversaw all the other Hebrew and Greek professors at Trinity College and was basically, you know, evaluating them on their skills as they taught other students. Dr. Roger Andrews was brother of Bishop Lancet Andrews, who was on the first company, and he was a fellow of Pembroke Hall, a doctor of divinity, and then master of Jesus College. You know, one thing that kind of amazes me is the amount of colleges and universities that were given to Bible teaching and Bible doctrine in the 1600s that these men were over and teaching in. So, you know, this was just kind of like the top cream of the crop. There were probably literally thousands of students learning the Bible at this time, and shows you, you know, the level of maturity of England at the time relative to the Word of God and the Bible and the desire for the things of God at the time. You had Dr. Robert Spalding, was a fellow of St. John College, Regius Professor of Hebrew at Cambridge. Dr. Andrew Bing, a fellow of Peterhouse, Regius Professor of Hebrew at Cambridge, and studied with Dr. Spalding. And then Archdeacon, he was also an Archdeacon at Norwich. And then we have the first Oxford Company, the third company. And this group was composed of seven translators who translated Isaiah to Malachi. And so the head of that was John Harding. He was a Regius Professor of Hebrew, president of Magdalen College at one point, and Royal Professor of Hebrew at Magdalen for 13 years. The fact that he occupied the chair for 13 years says a lot when thousands of people were studying sacred literature in England at this time. Next of all, we have Dr. John Reynolds. He was a fellow of Corpus Christi College, president of Corpus Christi College after that, and primarily responsible in the Conference of Hampton Court for moving King James to do a translation of the Bible. So this guy was influential in convincing King James that they needed a Bible translated in English. And he died in 1607 before the translation was completed, but he was a converted Roman Catholic who became a Puritan. He was an ardent and active Anabaptist, and studied the scriptures in the original language and read all the Greek and Latin fathers. And he was subjected to a fake deathbed recantation, which was kind of common at that time, of his faith in Rome. So basically the Roman Catholic Church was constantly trying to get people to go back on what they believe and say you accept the Roman Catholic doctrine. But he basically, somebody caught on to it, and they wrote a statement up and he signed it before he died, and disproving that. Dr. Thomas Holland was a fellow at Balliol College in Oxford. I don't know if you understand how universities are put together, but you have basically have colleges within universities, and that's kind of what Balliol College was. a subset of Oxford University. And so he was a chaplain to the Earl of Leicester in the Netherlands in 1585. He was called an Apollos, mighty in the scriptures. He's also a fiery Puritan and a dedicated anti-Catholic. You had Dr. Richard Kilby, rector of Lincoln College, Regius Professor of Divinity, published commentaries on Exodus. After the translation of the Bible, Dr. Kilby attended church where this is just an anecdotal story, but Dr. Kilby attended church where a young preacher was preaching, and that preacher found exception to one word, and during his preaching, he gave three reasons why it was wrong or translated wrong. Later that evening, Dr. Kilby, a rather humble man, told the man the committee had considered all three of his reasons when translating that particular word, but found 13 more considerable reasons why it was translated as printed. And so that's where your modern Bible scholars at. They think they got something, new knowledge or something like that over the King James translators. But in reality, there was a lot more that went on behind the scenes that was probably never documented, but a lot of depth in the translation. And it shows how shallow people are who try to correct the Bible. And then you have Miles Smith. He was a canon of Hereford, Bishop of Gloucester, and he had a great wealth of knowledge concerning Greek and Latin fathers of the Bible. He could carry on a conversation in Chaldean, Syriac, and Arabic. He had Hebrew so well mastered that it was said to be at his fingertips, or fingers end. He read every book he had in his own library. I can't say that. And he was one of the committee who reviewed the entire translation before it was sent to the printer. He also wrote the preface of the King James Bible, which we read a small snippet of that today. And then you had Dr. Richard Brett, a fellow of Lincoln College, rector of Quinton and Berkshire. He was a noted scholar of Greek, Hebrew, Latin, Aramaic, Chaldean, Arabic, and Ethiopian. And then you had Richard Fairclough. He was at New College, a fellow of Corpus Christi, and a vicar at Lambeth. Then we move into the second set of committees, the second Westminster Company. So this group contained seven men and translated Romans to Jude. And so that was headed up by Dr. William Barlow, who was a prebendary of Westminster, a dean of Chester, a bishop of Rochester, and was one of the divines selected by the Hampton Court. Dr. Ralph Hutchison was a president of St. John's College. Dr. John Spencer, vicar of Alavine, vicar of Broxbourne. Dr. Roger Fenton was a fellow of Pembroke Hall at Cambridge and a vicar at Chigwell. Dr. Michael Rabbit, rector at St. Van Dest, Forest Lane in London, Thomas Sanderson, Archdeacon of Rochester. And then last of all, William Dakins, Vicar of Trumpington, Professor of Divinity at Gresham College, and he had knowledge of the original languages. And then we have the second Oxford Company. This company consisted of 11 men, and they translated the four Gospels, Acts, and Revelation. And so that was headed up by Dr. Thomas Ravis. He's rector of All Hallows at Barking, canon of Westminster, and he was famous for his eminent learning, gravity, and prudence. Dr. George Abbott, master of University College at Oxford, dean of Winchester. Dr. Richard Edis, he was a prebendary of Salisbury, dean of Worcester, and he was greatly admired for his preaching, and he died shortly after the translation was begun. In 1604. And then Dr. Gillis Thompson was a fellow of All Souls, Dean of Windsor and Bishop of Gloucester. He died in 1612, shortly after the translation, to the great grief of all that knew the piety and learning of the man, after he had taken a great deal of pains at the command of King James in translating the four Gospels, Acts of the Apostles, and the Apocalypse. Then you had Dr. Henry Saville, was a fellow at Merton, knighted in 1604. founded the Seville Professors of Geometry and Astronomy in Oxford. He was known for his Greek and mathematical learning, and he was a Greek and mathematical tutor to Queen Elizabeth when she was young during the reign of her father, Henry VIII. So these were some pretty great men of God and well-learned in a lot of different things. Had John Perrin, a fellow at St. John's College. He's a Regius Professor of Greek. He resigned from his post to work on the Bible translation. Dr. Ralph Ravens, Vicar of Easton at Magna in Essex. A person of the same name at Queen's College, MA in 1595. Dr. John Harmar, Fellow of New College, Regius Professor of Greek, Warden of Winchester College. He translated Beza's sermons into English as well. Dr. Leonard Hutton, Vicar of Floor, Prebendary of St. Paul's. John Aglabinby, Royal Chaplain, Principal at St. Edmund's Hall, Oxford. And he was appointed to replace Dr. Eads, who died in 1604. Dr. John Montague, he was first master of Puritan Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge. Dean of Lichfield, edited and translated the works of King James I. There is some that question as to Montague's participation in the committee. Not sure why, but there was. And then you have the Second Cambridge Company. This company consisted of seven men who translated the Apocrypha. And like I said, the Apocrypha was translated primarily as historical material. And obviously we don't still have that in the King James Bible. But there were seven men on the committee that translated it. John DePort was a rector of Fulham, a presbyter of St. Paul's. Dr. William Branwaite, founding fellow of Emmanuel College. He was an Anabaptist, and was added to the translation committee to replace a suspected Roman Catholic spy who had been dismissed. So they were pretty much on guard pretty strongly for Catholics infiltrating this, and they weren't, you know, with everything going on in England and, you know, the gunpowder plot and who knows what else, their radar was on the whole time. Jeremy Radcliffe, fellow at Trinity College, Cambridge. He was also a vicar of Evesham and a vice master of Trinity College. Samuel Ward was a Puritan, a friend and correspondent of Archbishop Usher, who did basically the timeline we have in the Scofield Bible and wrote a very extensive timeline of the Bible. A fellow of Emmanuel, Master of Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge. He was a King's Chaplain in 1611, and he was famous for his diversified learning, especially biblical and oriental criticism. And then you had Dr. Andrew Downs. He was a Regius Professor of Greek at Cambridge. Him and Boyce were involved with the selection of revisers from the various translators. And then Dr. John Boyce was a Greek lecturer at Cambridge as well. A prebendary at Ely, and he's considered one of the finest Greek scholars in the kingdom. He was extremely well acquainted with Hebrew. At the age of 5 or 6, John had read his Bible through and was freely writing in Hebrew. I don't think there's too many kids around like that today. He wrote a book on Latin, of Latin notes on the four Gospels that was published after his death. And he also wrote notes on Chrysostom and with Sir Henry Civil and John Boyce. And then last of all, Robert Ward, a fellow at King's College, Cambridge, and a rector of bishops at Waltham in Hampshire. And so in conclusion, the men who translated the King James Bible were assembled in a manner that was never undertaken since on a national level. And there will never be another undertaking of this magnitude to translate the Bible. The translators in this effort, like I said, was a national effort in England that called on far and near to undertake. You know, this level of scholarship that they had at the time, along with their pietiness and godliness of the group of men to translate the Bible has never been replicated in any language or at any time compared to these group of men. Any questions? They had lots of like prebendary and vicar and No, I don't know if it was a commission thing. I think it was more of a Church of England. Tim's looking at me like he knows. Okay.
You were looking at me like you
I think, you know, like that term prebendary is still used today in the Church of England. It's like these guys get a stipend to stay in the church and they're paid. There's some weird hierarchies in the Church of England. They go way, 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 way back. Probably, yeah, I think so. They didn't escape everything. There's no way. Okay, thanks. Oops.